Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hey, everyone. Thanks, as always, for joining us here on The Avid Reader, sponsored by my bookshop, Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, our guest is Nicole Perlroth, author of This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, published by Bloomsbury in February. Nicole covers cybersecurity and digital espionage for the New York Times. She's written about Russian hacks, North Korean attacks, Iranian attacks, Chinese attacks, and a month-long attack of her own periodical. Of course, Trump is thrown in there as he has involvement in a lot of this as well, as you might expect. This, her first book, which would scare the crap out of anyone, which is what everybody says, deals with the global cyber arms race. The book, along with many of her Times articles, have been optioned for television as well. So anyway, the world ends because we've gotten ahead of ourselves. Ever since ARPANET, we have known one way or another that things could go south in a hurry. And just as getting older, things start going faster, and then they start going faster and faster, until you end up with a situation which seems to bode an end of things, an end that is not particularly cheerful or inviting. We'll start with a deductive form of reasoning, looking at the big picture and then drilling down into the massive legwork that Nicole had to do to get us to a point where we understand, unfortunately, or by how you look at it, exactly where we stand today. So welcome, Nicole, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So since I'm a bookseller, I'm always interested in titles, covers, and epigraphs. They paint, at least to me, a broad picture of what we, you know, like the outside of a jigsaw puzzle, what we might find inside. So the first thing I was interested in the cover, because at first I thought, okay, this is just like a regular cover and it's cool. And then I looked at it and I realized, since the letters are kind of disjointed and buzzing around, it gives you this idea that like something's not right. Was that something you vetted or you just liked it? Because it's really cool, but you don't notice it immediately.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't my concept, but I was worried that there was going to be a cover proposal for explosions with bombs or, you know, who knows what. And I did not want that to be the case. So I was really happy when they came to me with this print cover. And what I love about it is what you just seemed to get, which was that it looked like it was a little glitchy.
Yeah.
And when I was creating my own website for the book, I asked a web designer if he could take that same lettering and have it glitch out, which is what it does. You sort of see these letters flicker in and out on the website. And I think you get a little taste of that with the book cover, but obviously it's a long title too. Yeah. So there was the problem of trying to fit it all in on a cover. And I think they did a good job, or as good as you could do with a title like this.
Yeah. And it's interesting because the title is like, okay, Nicole's done all this work and she's the one who's telling me this. So who's telling her this? And I guess it's all the cowboys and the other people that you dealt with throughout this book, correct?
Yeah. You know, when I was covering these attacks for the New York Times every day, and I started to get some outreach from publishers. And they said, you know, you should really consider writing a book about this. And the last thing I wanted to do after a full day of covering nonstop nation state attacks on the United States was go home and write about nonstop nation state attacks on the United States. But one of the things that these publishers said is you can't write a book until you find your donkey. You know, you can't do the book until you find the person that can carry the narrative all the way through. And if you read the book, it really jumps back and forth in chronology. It dates back at some points to the Cold War. Sometimes I go back and retrace the steps after ARPANET, when people were first raising red flags about how this technology could be used to intercept our communications or our critical infrastructure. And so I knew that I was going to have to be the donkey, that I was going to have to take the reader by the hand and lead them into this world, and that we were going to be shifting around in time and space. But the they in the title, This Is How They Tell Me the World Ends, is fairly constant throughout the book. They at some points are government officials who are raising these red flags very early on in the 1960s, Later, it's people like Leon Panetta, the former Secretary of Defense, who famously stood upon the on top of the Intrepid and warned that we were due for a cyber 9/11. Sometimes it's people in the cyber arms market themselves saying we're very worried about these capabilities drifting overseas to nation states that would have their own reasons for using these to attack the United States or spy on journalists or dissidents. And I'm constantly getting these warnings. And by the end, you know, in the beginning, you're a journalist, you're a skeptic, you know, to take all of these claims with a grain of salt. And sure, there's a fair amount of marketing involved when cybersecurity companies lay out the worst case scenario. But by the end of the book, and by the end of the last 10 years I've spent covering these attacks, I sort of have become one of these people, which is, you know, we are in a very dire situation when it comes to cyber attacks and the cyber threats to our critical infrastructure. And, you know, it might not end the world, but, you know, where we are right now is in a very precarious place. Our power grid has been infiltrated. We've seen Russia get into our nuclear plants. We've seen them dismantle the safety locks at a petrochemical plant. We've seen them target our elections. And we've seen countries like Iran and North Korea that have longed for these same capabilities. They're not where we are in terms of the United States capabilities, but they're far enough along that they can do a lot of damage with far less sophisticated code. And they are coming for our critical infrastructure. And we are in a place where I think most Americans don't realize how precarious the situation is. But, you know, people are in their grid. They're waiting for the right geopolitical trigger to do some harm.
Yeah, that's what really scared me the most. And then I thought, you know, how you end the book, jumping around, which I wasn't going to do, how you end the book in all caps, that really got to me, because it was like, okay, what am I supposed to do? Because then I was thinking, you know, we're supposed to be carbon neutral by 2030 and 2040. No way. We're going to change gun laws or stop racism or even help the bees to survive.
Yeah.
I don't even think we'll accomplish any of those. And then I'm looking at this and I realize, like you said, and we'll talk about the Ukrainian thing, like kind of being a dry run or a spring training, waiting for, as you said, a geopolitical event to just say, okay, it's just going to be like an EMP and we're going to knock out everything at once. That's why it was cool that you said you didn't want the cover to be a bomb, because it's not like that at all. And I think it's, you know, really good that it wasn't that cover, because people would think of it in a completely different way. And then the other thing is, I like the way that you were talking about being the donkey, because the book can be read as two books. One, it's just like a straight science cyber book. But then the other side, I was going to say like a thriller or a spy novel, but it's almost like a cowboy story. It's almost like this Western. And that's what makes the book very, very accessible, I think.
I love that. I went to go see this exhibit at the Vancouver Art Gallery. I was in Vancouver for a very famous hacking conference that happens every year called Pwn to Own, which has this famous competition where they have hackers try and get into your iPhone and your MacBook, and whoever can do it in the quickest amount of time wins that piece of technology, or a Tesla, I think, was the last prize. And I happened to be walking by the Vancouver Art Gallery, and they had this exhibit, and this was at the very beginning stages of outlining my book, and it was called the Mashup Exhibit. And outside it said, the sign outside said Tarantino, Picasso, David Byrne, you know, it was all these like pop culture names up there and famous artists. And when I went inside, it featured artists that had mashed up genres in different ways, like Tarantino has done with old Western films and also Kung Fu films and Hitchcock. And it really kind of opened my eyes to the fact that, wow, you know, that's a little bit like hackers, where they're taking something that was designed for one system or one genre or one purpose, and they're using it for another. And it really left an impression on me. And it was sort of one of the things I wanted to do with the book, or just ended up through osmosis seeping its way into the narrative, was pulling in these different genres. Like when I wrote the chapter on the godfather of cyber warfare, on Jim Gosler, to me, he was really the Wizard of Oz. Yeah. And, you know, when you get to him at the very end, he's basically saying, I also think that we are in a very vulnerable spot. Yes, I have led a lot of the programs that exploit our digital vulnerabilities in the name of national security. But I am very worried about the state of cybersecurity. And the cowboy chapter is really, you know, a guy who comes in from Texas, has no background in computer technology or information security, and shakes up the model and starts paying hackers for their bugs. So I'm glad you picked up on that.
And there, you know, I'm not looking away from you. I'm just writing stuff down as quickly as I can, because everything raises a question in my head, and my notes will be gone. But two things. Let me see which one I can tell you first. Okay, yeah. So all the hackers are like, you know, some of them look like, you know, bums. Some of them look like spies. They're all different kinds of looks. But this is like kind of a pivotal point in the book. I have no idea why, but when the one guy goes, I'd rather talk to you about my salmon, and you bring it up later in the book and it kind of ties it up. Talk about what that really means, because it's a great line.
Thank you. Yeah. It was that chapter is about the most awkward dinner of my life and certainly my career. I was sitting at a dinner ahead of a conference on critical infrastructure security, where they just had hackers getting on stage demonstrating all the ways that they could break into critical infrastructure like the grid. And that night, Dale Peterson, who organized the conference, had invited and one other journalist, and then Ralph Langner, who is a German cybersecurity industrial control security expert, who was the first to publicly call out the United States and Israel as playing major roles in Stuxnet, the attack, cyber attack that took out Iran's nuclear centrifuges. And he was obviously very intimately aware of holes in our critical infrastructure. And then the other two guests were these two Italian guys, Luigi and Donato, who were finding holes in critical infrastructure, not so they could patch them, but so they could sell them to governments. And I had heard murmurings before that there was a gray market for that hackers could find vulnerability in systems like Microsoft Windows and sell it off to a broker and eventually government agencies who would use that to spy on terrorists or law enforcement. But until that dinner, I didn't know that there was a market for vulnerabilities in the grid, in hospital networks, in gas pipelines. And that just blew me away. And so we're sitting at this dinner, and I think Dale's goal was that we would all have a lively discussion, but I just noted from the very beginning that Ralph intentionally was turning his back towards these Italians and wanted nothing to do with them, because he knew the risk of a cyber attack, what the risk of a cyber attack on our critical infrastructure could look like. Anyway, I, throughout the dinner, tried to ask a basic question of the Italians, which was, who will you sell these vulnerabilities to? And more importantly, who will you not? You know, Iran, China, Russia, you know, where is the red line here? But I also knew that no one in their business can talk about their customers, because they're locked in through non-disclosure agreements. And also, a lot of these tools are making their way into classified government programs. And governments are willing to spend millions of dollars on these capabilities, on these holes in the code to exploit them. And you know, they don't want to see those millions of dollars turn to mud. And the way they turn to mud is if a company like Microsoft learns about that underlying flaw in their system and patches it. We all patch it, and suddenly those millions of dollars that a government broker, government agency just spent on that hole turns to dust. So that dinner, we're sitting there, I'd come at the question a couple different ways, they each refused to answer. And finally, we were about two or three glasses of wine deep, and I said, so who will you not sell these capabilities to? Iran, China? And I directed the question at Luigi, because he spoke the better English of the two. And he just stared at his salmon for an inordinately long amount of time. I mean, it was the most awkward silence I've ever witnessed. And I could just feel Ralph next to me with his jaw clenching and his fists clenching the longer that he refused to answer my question. And finally, Luigi said, I could answer your question, but I would much rather talk about my salmon. And at that point, Ralph just exploded and he turned to me and he said something to the effect of, Nicole, these men are young. They are your age. They have no idea what they are doing or how dangerously this will end. And then he turned back to him and said, but go ahead and tell us about your fucking salmon. And to me, it was just the perfect encapsulation of everything everyone in this industry didn't want to talk about, that they were sort of selling the blood diamonds of our technology space, and that these capabilities were eventually going to make their way into a cyber attack on our critical infrastructure that could potentially take lives. And the fucking salmon phrase just stuck with me throughout writing this book. And ultimately, I realized it was a great narrative tool, because there were so many people in the space that didn't want to talk about their customers and didn't want to address the moral hazard baked into this market. And so every time someone refused to answer my question, I would just say, the fucking salmon, you know, and it just became this great narrative tool.
And that's the funny thing. It's like, as soon as I read it, I thought it was pivotal. And I like to hear you say it was, because not only was the language of what was going on clear, but this really strange interpersonal dynamic between everyone, which you really did a good job of doing without like just coming out and saying they hated each other. That was really good, because you began to see that, well, man, I was thinking, why don't they take some of these people out? I got really scared because I thought, you know, they're really going to like terminate with extreme prejudice. But the other thing, since you mentioned that, the one thing I want to talk about that I think readers and listeners will not believe, we'll talk about Ukraine, I promise, but the Jeep, what they did to the Jeep.
Oh, yeah. So that is a story where Charlie Miller and another researcher who I apologize, Chris Vlasic, I think, they hacked their way into Jeep system. I should say Chrysler, because Chrysler owns Jeep. And they famously had a former colleague, a friend of mine, Andy Greenberg, who I think was at Wired at the time, get in the Jeep. And while he was driving on the freeway, they started hacking his speed and his steering and messing with the brakes and messing with the radio unit to demonstrate that they could hack a Jeep. And ultimately, I think Chrysler had to do a recall on Jeeps because this capability was out there. And of course, now we're headed into the age of autonomous vehicles. Mm-hmm. And this is a major theme of the book, is we still haven't figured out the security of our basic systems and cars and grid and hospitals and oil infrastructure and gas pipelines, but we're moving into the world of artificial intelligence and machine learning and virtualization. And so when I started writing the book, I really wanted to do it pretty quickly. When I sold it, I promised to get it done in 9 months. That never happened, but I was hoping to beat this wave of the Internet of Things. And I totally missed that. You know, we have just hooked up our Alexas and our Google Homes and our Nests, and we're moving into autonomous vehicles. So, you know, I'm too late to get ahead of the Internet of Things, but now the book's coming out when we are really just about to turn on artificial intelligence in major ways. And, you know, that presents even more complexity and even more vulnerability.
Like every day we make it easier and easier. And the thing about it is, and we can go to the Ukraine now, is that the Ukraine, as you say, is a lot more protected than us, because they aren't digital. They have paper ballots. They aren't hooked up to a grid everywhere. It always reminds me of the Minuteman silos. I feel kind of secure about them because they're so antiquated, but I think they're still using 5.5-inch floppy disks. I think that's the only safe thing we have. But if that's not safe, holy shit. I mean, so why don't you give us an idea of what happened in the Ukraine and why it really scares you, because of what it meant the Russians were really setting up for.
Yeah, and I should probably back up and start with the NSA.
Yeah.
You know, when I started this book, I was really interested in this moral hazard of, you know, the fact that 3 decades ago, if we found a hole in Huawei's software or hardware, we weren't necessarily required to tell Huawei about it, because for the most part, Americans weren't using Huawei software and hardware, but our adversaries were. China was obviously using it, but also North Korea and Syria and Sudan and Iran, and places that didn't necessarily trust US technology to not be a backdoor for US intelligence agencies. So if we found a hole in Huawei systems, we wouldn't tell anyone about it. And there was no harm, no foul to Americans because we weren't using that vulnerable system. Well, three decades later, Huawei is a glaring exception. But for the most part these days, we're all using the same software and hardware. We're all using Android phones and iPhones and Microsoft Windows and Cisco. And so when the NSA found a hole in those systems, I was fascinated by the fact that they would also be leaving Americans more vulnerable when they wouldn't patch that hole and instead hold on to it to spy on terrorists or to net counterintelligence, et cetera. So when I started writing this book, that was the moral hazard I really wanted to focus on. And I was really thinking about it in terms of a theoretical, you know, what would happen, for instance, if the US held on to a vulnerability in Microsoft Windows, which we use for our communications, but also in the power grid and other critical systems. What if someone found out about that hole and used it back on us? You know, are we taking that into account when we make these decisions over whether to keep or turn over a zero-day hole in software? What I never expected is that someone would come along and hack the NSA's tools and stockpile of these vulnerabilities in the code to exploit it. And that is exactly what happened in 2016, 2017, 3 or 4 years after I signed up to do this book. Someone, we have no idea who they are, they call themselves the Shadow Brokers, appeared on Twitter, claimed to have hacked the NSA, and over a period of several months started dribbling out some of the NSA's best kept code and secrets. And in 2017, and I think it was in March, they dumped one of the NSA's most coveted holes and exploits in Microsoft Windows software. And 1 month later, we saw North Korea pick up the NSA's code and use it in a global ransomware attack that hit hospitals in the United Kingdom, hit law firms in the United States, hit police agencies and universities all over the world. Fortunately, North Korea was pretty sloppy with the code, and a hacker was able to come along and neutralize the attack pretty quickly. But then 1 month later, Russia picked up the NSA's tool and they used it in an attack on Ukraine. And they got into a tax software company used by most Ukrainian government agencies and businesses. They sent their malware in that way. And then they held those systems hostage with what we thought was ransomware, but was actually just destructive malware. But it didn't just hit Ukraine, it hit any business that even had a single employee working remotely from Ukraine. So it boomeranged down around the world. It hit Pfizer, it hit FedEx, it hit Merck. It paralyzed Merck's vaccine production systems that year. So Merck actually had to tap into the CDC's emergency stockpiles of Gardasil vaccine. It hit Cadbury egg factories in Tasmania, on and on and on and on. But what happened was, and I was super pregnant when this happened, and so I had to wait to go to Ukraine until my baby was, a few months old. But I went to Ukraine because I wanted to see what ground zero looked like for that attack. And when I got there a year and a half, 2 years later, their railway systems were still not completely functioning. People still hadn't received their pension checks because the attack had hit their post service. They were really still reckoning with this. In fact, the attack actually hit Chernobyl, the old nuclear site, and took out the systems that monitor for radiation leaks. So they had to send out people to manually measure radiation levels by hand. So it really did a number on Ukraine. But what was really interesting, and I don't think I could have understood this until I went to Ukraine, was in speaking with the security researchers and forensics guys who picked up and unraveled the code from that attack, was they said, listen, they were clearly doing a dry run here. You know, in every attack we've seen from Russia, we've seen them use one attack method here, another method there, one tool here, another tool here. We actually think that this attack was a way for them to wipe these systems clean of all the other previous code and tools that they had used on our system. So just basically torch the whole thing after years of experimentation. And we've seen them back off quite a bit. And we think it's because we are their test kitchen. They have been employing all forms of the scientific method on our systems, but we believe that we were just a dry run for a future attack on the United States and your closest allies. And when it comes your way, you are going to be much worse off because you are so much more wired and virtualized and digitized than we are here. And like you said, they pointed out that they would never even dare use ballot marking machines like Dominion or ES&S and all the names we know well after the 2020 election for their elections. They still conduct their elections with pen and paper. Their grid is still not fully virtualized in the way ours is. Their energy economy and industry is still not virtualized the way ours is. So they basically said, you Americans need to wake up and pay attention to what is happening in Ukraine because it is coming your way. And when it does, it is going to be much more costly and destructive than it has been for us.
How come? Oh, you know what we haven't even talked about, which is the structural foundation of your book, is Zero Day. You just mentioned it, but no one knows what it is. You need to fill us in on that.
Yeah, I mean, I've touched on it a little bit, but you know, let's just use the easiest example, which is if I'm a hacker and I find a hole in your iPhone's iOS software that Apple doesn't know about, that's called a zero day. Because when it is discovered, researchers and companies have had 0 days to patch it. And there's this very important period between when a zero day is discovered and when the patch is developed and rolled into your software updates and you hit update my software, that cyber criminals and nation states can go seize that vulnerability and use it to spy on systems. That actually just happened today. The NSA tipped off Microsoft to several zero days in its email exchange servers. And so if I am a hacker and I find that zero day and I develop a program to exploit it to say, read your text messages or turn on your camera without you knowing about it or track your location, I can sell that to a zero day broker. And there are many here in the United States who actively advertise their prices on their websites, not on the dark web, just on their websites. And they will, the going rate in the United States is $2.5 million. For that iOS remote zero day exploit can get me to spy on your phone. And when that is sold, if I'm a hacker, the only caveat is I can't tell Apple about it. Because if Apple finds out about that zero day, they patch it. And suddenly that $2.5 million that zero day broker and then their customers at government agencies spent to acquire that capability turns to dust. So that is what a zero day is and what a zero day exploit is. But over the last 10 years, we have seen other countries start acquiring zero day exploits too. We've seen brokers pop up in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates that will offer $3 million for that same zero day exploit I just mentioned that you could fetch $2.5 million for in the United States. But they're not necessarily using it to spy on terrorists as we see them. They're using them to spy on their own people, on their Twitter critics, on journalists and dissidents, and their enemies in Qatar and elsewhere. And that is sort of the case for every country. You know, I've covered attacks from Mexico that uses these capabilities to spy on nutritionists. And when I scratched at that one, it turns out that the people that they were spying on had at one point all publicly advocated for a national soda tax in Mexico. You know, Mexico is one of Coca-Cola's biggest markets. Yeah. And someone clearly in government was getting kickbacks from the soda industry and didn't want to see that soda tax pass and were taking aim at the people who were publicly out there advocating for a soda tax. And I only tell that story to say every country, every government agency, every government minder has their own reason for acquiring and deploying these tools. And they don't necessarily have the red tape that we have here in the United States that prevents government agencies from spying on journalists for the most part, or dissidents or others. So that is the moral hazard I wanted to explore.
Well, the one that's closest, I think, to, and even it was bad, but it wasn't as bad as it could have been, is SolarWinds. Talk a little bit about what happened with Solar. I like the password SolarWinds 123. That's what I do. It's what, the way I do passwords.
SolarWinds. So, you know, I was rushing to finish this book before the 2020 election. And then because of COVID, it didn't come out until February. And I thought that the election was going to be the big moment, but it turns out that the big moment happened after the book had already gone to press. And that big moment is, as you say, the SolarWinds attack. So just to back up, SolarWinds is a Texas company. You use their software to get better visibility into what's on your network. You want to know what cloud applications employees are using, or how much data is migrating to their personal devices, or what kind of programs they're downloading onto their work computers. You can use SolarWinds to get a better picture of what is going on. And that is a critical necessity these days. So SolarWinds is used by most US federal agencies, also utility companies. More than 400 of the Fortune 500 use it. It actually marketed itself also as a security company, which was highly dubious when they used passwords like SolarWinds 123. But essentially what it was the lowest common denominator for Russia to get into our systems in the same way that they hijacked that Ukrainian tax software company. They hijacked SolarWinds software updates, planted their malware into the software update, and that update made its way to 18,000 of SolarWinds clients. That's the bad news. The other piece of bad news here is that we have seen Russia several times now, for the most part in Ukraine, use that access to paralyze systems, to hold them hostage, to turn off the lights in a couple of cases in Ukraine. But the good news is, in this case, we think this was a highly targeted attack aimed at US federal agencies and some of the companies like FireEye and Microsoft that provide them with security and technology. And the other piece of good news is we think this is the SVR, which is not the same unit that turned off the lights in Ukraine or decimated data. The SVR is more of a traditional classic espionage unit that's really known as quiet prowlers. You know, they are there for espionage, to read emails and strategy planning documents. So in some ways, that's the good news, because they could have used this access to turn off the lights and decimate data. But we believe this was a classic espionage operation. The problem is getting them out. And the problem is that it doesn't eliminate the possibility that they would eventually use this access for more destructive purposes. And this particular actor, if it is the SVR, like intelligence agencies in the US think it is, we know them well, because they actually hacked the State Department and the White House in 2014, 2015. And when I interviewed the people who were in charge of remediating that attack, they described the process of kicking Russian hackers out as hand-to-hand digital combat. At one point, the Russian hackers took over their tools that they were using, their investigative tools that search for and identify backdoors, to manipulate it so it would not identify Russian backdoors. And the Russians really exploited this time horizon in 2019, 2020, when we were all focused on threats to the election. It turns out they weren't focused on the election. They used that as a distraction to hack the federal agencies themselves. And what's still stunning to me is, so much about this attack is still coming out, but they had 9 months, we think, inside our systems before they were discovered. And some of the big things here are, the US intelligence agencies didn't find them. A private company did. In fact, the NSA, you know, despite all of our fear and paranoia about the NSA's capabilities, especially after the Snowden releases, we forget that the NSA can't spy on domestic systems. So they actually didn't pick this up, because this was an attack that Russia staged from inside the US through SolarWinds in Texas, and also through GoDaddy servers in New Jersey. So we totally missed it. The other thing is, 9 months is a long time for this actor to be in our systems without us knowing about it. And that's 9 months where they could compromise other applications and plant other backdoors. It could be years before we get them out. And then the other thing that's really stunning to me is, on election day, I was part of a group of reporters who were getting these bi-hourly briefings from the Department of Homeland Security, some cases from Chad Wolf himself, to assure us that they had been monitoring for foreign interference and they weren't seeing it. And as Chris Krebs, the head of CISA, the cybersecurity agency at DHS, told us, it's just another Tuesday on the internet. You know, we think we're safe. We think we've seen some smooth sailing here. Well, at that very moment, we're learning right now, Russians were inside Chad Wolf's email inbox, reading his emails. You know, so that is just stunning. And so there's so much about the SolarWinds attack to be fearful of, but it also is worth caveating with the fact that we think this was classic espionage that the US does all the time. And how do you respond to an attack that you yourselves have successfully pulled off for decades?
You know, one of the things that, and you mentioned his name, and I was going to get to it next anyway, as we get towards the end here, is Snowden. I mean, you go into what he did in great detail, but, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but I am of two minds. One side of me wants to give him the Congressional Medal of Honor, and the other side is not so sure. And a lot of people in the United States, perhaps more than half, want him to go to jail or be convicted of treason and worse than go to jail. Where do you come down on that? I don't quite know.
Yeah, it's a hard question. And I'm glad you got the sense that I don't quite know from the book. But, you know, I have a couple of thoughts. You know, there were rumors that he was some sort of Russian asset. I don't think that's true. But there's no question that Putin has used Snowden's presence in Moscow as like a big game trophy. And that's one thing that we have to consider. Another is he opened up these debates about domestic surveillance and NSA surveillance in a way that no one could have before him, because all of this was so classified. And I think overclassification is a huge problem in the intelligence community. That said, he released a lot of documents. You know, we think tens of thousands. I certainly had privileged access to thousands of NSA documents. And I think he could have just as easily gotten his point across with more selective leaks, or possibly even through the whistleblower process. And that is still up for question and still up for debate, whether there were flaws in the NSA's whistleblower process. But he dumped a lot. And he also gave them to people like Glenn Greenwald, which are not known for being, you know, a neutral, unbiased party. You know, he gave them to someone who on some level is an activist and has very strong feelings about the United States and its intelligence community. But like I said, on the other hand, he cracked open these debates in ways that I don't think would have been possible, maybe even through the whistleblower process. So I'm very conflicted about Edward Snowden. Yeah. And, you know, I think it's uncomfortable because you think as a journalist, one should always be on the side of more transparency. And I think I do feel that way about him, but I also wonder if there were other ways or other means he could have pursued to get out the same message and open up these debates. And I just don't know.
So anyway, so we've been on this for about an hour, and I would love to do a part two and part three because I got pages of notes. But to conclude today, and I would be happy if you came back, but to conclude today would be, okay, so you end the book, you're saying, let's do something about this. And I understand that, but I wouldn't say you're even cautiously optimistic, but you tell me, are we totally screwed or not? Give me 2 minutes of that and then we'll go. Because I don't want, if we go too long, I won't be able to fit it on YouTube.
Yeah. You know, it is, and you mentioned this earlier about the bees and climate change. I think of it a lot like that. You know, I think of it as this existential crisis that businesses play a big role in, but that individuals also have a role to play, and that governments clearly have a role to play. And I think the biggest problem in this space has been one of communication and one of awareness, which I know sounds lame, but unfortunately, that's just the case. I don't think people realize just how vulnerable they are. I don't think people realize that, you know, in the absence of any legislation mandating stricter cybersecurity standards for companies like utilities, et cetera, we are really leaving it to the market and to incentive models to dictate our cybersecurity. And in the book, I look at each one of those incentive structures. And for individuals, we just want what we want right now, as quickly as possible. And we don't want to be bothered with software updates and complicated passwords and two-factor authentication. Businesses just want to keep moving fast and break things, as Mark Zuckerberg put it. They just want to get their software to market as quickly as possible before the competition so they can gain as much market share as possible and win. And they'll fix the security problems later. But that software is making its way into our critical infrastructure and into our autonomous vehicles. And government, for too long, I think, has been prioritizing national security over cybersecurity. You know, I don't think people were aware that the government was stockpiling vulnerabilities and widely available commercial technology that we rely on for our power to stay on and also for our most personal communications and medical records. And so what I really wanted to do was say, hey, everyone, wake up, because there's no cavalry coming here. There's no silver bullet. We all need to be made aware of the direness of this threat, and we all have a role to play. But like climate change, you know, it's a tough one, and we are not known for being long-term strategic thinkers. We're known for being quarterly thinkers, and this is a problem that is going to require so many different solutions, an entirely new way of doing business and conducting government and intelligence operations. And I think the first step is just making the average citizen aware, because for too long, we've left these conversations to classified government corridors in the cybersecurity industry. And the problem's not getting better. It's just getting worse as more nation states and cyber criminals see that there's a lot to be gained from hacking and from our global digital vulnerability. So are we screwed? Yes, yeah. We're screwed. But, you know, is there hope? Yes. And SolarWinds is a great example. It has left the Biden administration holding the hot potato. They have no choice but to address some of the solutions that have been tossed around in academia for years, but never actually put in place, like, how do we want to set up a real-time threat communication channel between businesses and government? Should we have a bill of materials where we each know what is in our computer or our grid and how secure it is? Should we only have American-made software in our systems? You know, should SolarWinds be fined for having SolarWinds 123 as its password? Or should we create tax incentives for companies that subject themselves to serious penetration tests? You know, these are all questions that people have sort of rolled around here and there, but now we actually have to answer them. And so I think there is going to be a lot that happens in this administration. And, you know, during the Trump administration, anything that happened in the name of cybersecurity happened at the kids' table or happened under cover of darkness. You know, every effort that CISA did to try and secure the election had to be hush hush, so Trump didn't find out about it because he didn't want to hear about election security. Good news is we're now talking about it.
You can't start with Trump, because then I'll go off and it'll take hours. I'm concluding. And I would love for you to come back, because I think we would have an excellent conversation on some of the minutiae and some of the smaller things, and also exactly what could happen. But the main thing here is we're trying to sell your book, and I have a bookstore, and it's on the front table. And people, you know, people say you can't judge a book by its cover. That's why I started with that. And they really do judge it, because it catches their eye.
Okay.
And after a minute, they get that. So publishers like to have good covers, because it sells books. But in any event, thank you so much for being here. I wish we could talk longer. And I just, the reason I'm saying, I just want to make sure I don't get screwed up and this doesn't get on YouTube. So if you ever want to come back, I'd be really happy to talk to you some more. So thank you.
I loved it. I loved it so much. And I'm going to borrow your phrasing. You know, I've been using the word dry run for what Russia has done in Ukraine, but I loved your phrasing around spring training. So maybe you'll see that pop up in the New York Times soon, because that's such a great phrase.
Give me a royalty, please.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you so much. Thanks everyone for listening.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.